Okay, welcome back to the show, Olivia, friend of the podcast. We spoke to you, oh my god, like over 2 years ago? No, almost 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think it was 2019.
Yeah, at my apartment in Washington Heights, I remember you schlepped it all the way to me.
It was worth it for Daisy.
Yes, exactly. That's what I can offer you. And I had no idea about microphones and settings, the episode. Oh, God. Well, hopefully I've learned something in that interim time. But thank you. So thank you once again for coming back. I'm glad that you were willing to do this, because what we're about to talk about today is very painful and it's not fun. And this is like my second hate watch that I've done and like recorded about in like 3 days. So I'm like, oh my God. So what I'll let you introduce it. What are we here to do today? Oh, God. Oh boy.
We are here to talk about Oslo, which was a play that ran off Broadway in 2016. It ran on Broadway in 2017. And a few weeks ago, the film adaptation of it landed on HBO. So
listen to me. This meeting is completely unofficial. You cannot even mention my ministry.
Trust me.
The Oslo Channel began with the hopes of creating a dialogue between the Palestinians and Israel. If this fails, lives will be ruined.
Why would I accept your help?
A discussion held somewhere isolated, where you and the PLO can meet.
I have never met an Israeli face to face.
In a secret Norwegian channel between Israel and the PLO.
You're a junior minister, Terry is just a sociologist.
You are my first Jew.
In my country, we see you as terrorists and murderers.
In my country, we see you as a savage nation whose army shoots our children for sport.
I can do business with this man.
The progress that was made in one two-day meeting, it's beyond imagination.
Their ways are strange, but through their methods, we have begun a true dialogue between our peoples.
Our countries live in the past, both obsessing over what we have lost. Let us find a way to live in the present.
Oh my God, they're laughing.
If you take one more step, I swear I will divorce you.
It is illegal for an Israeli official to speak to the PLO.
If you continue down this path and the world finds out what you are all doing, there will be riots. Blood will be spilled.
Your fighting is killing your own children.
Our fighting has forced you to fear us.
You will accept this document that we've all agreed to, and we are done.
I was thinking we could talk a little bit about the movie and the play, a couple of the differences in between, and the fact that it both versions were written and directed by the same pair of white men from America.
Yeah. So, boy, does this... I didn't even know that it was a play. You alerted me to this fact, and I'm going to link to your article, The Offensively Inoffensive, Oslo, The Pitfalls of Both Siding, and the Excruciating Neutral Operas of Bartlett Sher. Sher, is that right? Bartlett Sher?
Sher, yeah. Sher, yeah.
So I had seen it advertised and stuff, and I was like, what is this? But I don't know. It looked dumb, and I kind of like, I put it in the same category as I put Valley of Tears, which is another HBO sort of like historical drama. This one is Israeli, but they're both like kind of, both of these movies are linked to HBO. They're being broadcast, and they were purchased the rights to HBO, so they have that sort of quality of seriousness that HBO has, the kind of like cultural gravitas of that historical drama that's like bought and purchased and distributed by HBO or whatever. So I kind of dismissed it at first, and having watched it now, I realize why I dismissed it. But there's also more interesting things aside from its many aesthetic failures, like the corny, whatever, like tons of things I'm sure we'll go over, and you probably know much better than me because you've seen the source text. But I think it's interesting to see this movie now in light of what just happened, the most recent Gaza war, and the fundamental shift in sort of Palestinian liberation and like the struggle, like shift back towards armed struggle. So can you give us like an overview of this, the play to the movie? Because you know a lot about the play, obviously.
Yeah. So the article I wrote focused a little bit more on the director, Bartlett Sher, who is a theater and opera director. He grew up in San Francisco in the 60s. I think he was born in 1959. He is a 9-time Tony nominated director. He won the Tony once for his direction of the South Pacific revival on Broadway, I guess maybe about 10 years ago now. And he is very prone to making historical connections when he's directing a work. He likes to look at the connections between when a work is set and the era in which it was written. He was really fascinated by South Pacific, the musical, as not only a mirror of what racism was like in the United States during that sort of World War II to 1950s transition, but also he described South Pacific as a mirror of who we are as Americans today. And by today, I'm talking more about 2008-ish. He also was really famous for directing at the Metropolitan Opera, and one of his most notable productions was the first production of Verdi's Otello that abandoned the practice of blackface, which they had been doing since the Met opened, with tenors for singing the role. And in the last few years preceding that revival, they had, or preceding that new production in revivals, they had gone progressively lighter and lighter on the makeup, but that was kind of the major turning point, which, much like Oslo, was kind of boring and both sidesy. And he's also friends with the two Norwegian diplomats at the center of Oslo, Taya Reid-Larsen and Mona Juul. Their daughters went to school together. That's how this play came together, because J.T. Rogers, who's the playwright behind this, he has a track record of writing plays. He likes to say that he's interested in people who are, you know, caught in the web of history, who struggle against historical events. And in exploring how that struggle changes them, he, in one very famous speech, called it theater that engages the public realm. And prior to Oslo, he had written a few plays. In 2004, he had written one about an American family in Rwanda during the genocide of the early 90s. In 2010, he wrote one called Blood and Gifts, which is set in Afghanistan during the 80s and was written as sort of a means of contextualizing the issues that we see in Afghanistan today and how it all kind of came together between the US, the USSR, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And that was the play that Bartlett Sher directed. And when they were working on that play, he brought in Taya Reid-Larsen to talk to the actors about diplomacy and all of this. And then I think they just got together for dinner one night, and Larsen and Juul kept talking about their sort of the stories. The Oslo Accords were a whole back channel secret process, and they had these stories of their, like, you know, the secrets behind the secrets of the back channels. And that was what led to them realizing that there was a play in that. And it went off Broadway. It's kind of a fallacy, but it's a little misleading to say it went off Broadway to Broadway, because they developed it in partnership with Lincoln Center Theater. And they have both an off Broadway and a Broadway house within the same complex at Lincoln Center. So they were developing this in.
Can you explain what that means to people? Because people might not know the difference between Broadway and off-Broadway.
Oh, yeah, totally. So I can't speak intelligently to the specific characteristics that they use to determine what is an off-Broadway house versus an off-off-Broadway. But there is a level of prestige in the New York theater world that goes in with Broadway houses. You have, you know, that kind of spot of land near Times Square, where there are a ton of theaters that are, you know, constitute what we would think of as the Broadway houses. You go to Times Square, you see The Lion King, you see Les Mis, you see Hamilton, and you're seeing them at one of those houses. And then there's kind of a progressively smaller and smaller or set of smaller theaters, or not even necessarily smaller in size, but smaller in however the theater wing wants to describe them. And so you have these two, and it just, you know, a lot of the qualifications come down to awards. The Tony Awards pertain to mainly Broadway productions. You have the OBs, which are the Off-Broadway Awards, I believe. So, you know, a lot of it comes down to, I think, branding and prestige. When you say you have a play on Broadway or even a play off-Broadway, there is a level of endorsement that comes with that type of a show.
And it suggests a certain quality, suggests a certain seriousness. And so it's interesting that this goes, this
well,
kind of...
Cats ran on Broadway, so...
No, I meant
quality
the
off- and seriousness with a grain of salt.
No, I meant, yeah, it's true, because there are different classes of theater goer, right? And that kind of, that distinction reflects on that. And our idea of theater is so, like, drenched in musical theater as well. The different sort of range of the things. And so I it's funny, I'm such like a novel guy. I always like, for me, and I've said this on this podcast before, but like, no, like plays and theaters are like such an afterthought for me. Like it's stupid. I shouldn't be saying that. It's like an uneducated thing to say ultimately, especially like given the fact that I did a PhD in comparative literature and I know better than to say that. But like, to me, theater is this antiquated form and I'd rather just see a movie because why would I even like upgrade? Why would I not upgrade like imaginatively, formally or whatever? But like, you could, when I was watching this, I realized, oh, this is like a certain theatrical mode of production is visible here because it's mostly people talking to other people in a room.
Well, it's just funny you say that in terms of that experience with watching plays and why the merit in it, because I think a lot of effective theater and a lot of really good theater is happening not on Broadway and not off Broadway, especially, you know, when I'm talking about theater here, I'm thinking more in terms of plays or they call it straight theater, which is kind of funny when you think about it. I think the case for what theater brings to us, and I say this as a former playwriting major, is that, you know, there are things that you can achieve in theater that you can't achieve in a book or in a film. And Broadway / off-Broadway are largely responsible for sanitizing that a bit and, you know, playing to the lowest common denominator.
Oh, right. So you're saying that like the commercialization, the American kind of culture industry and how what it does with theatrical sort of productions defangs it of its radical potential?
Yeah, and there's a lot. I mean, that's an entirely different discussion, but I think part of it comes from the fact that when, especially in the United States, you have far less state funding than you do in other countries for the arts. And so there is a large emphasis placed on what can sell and what isn't going to alienate audiences. And certainly, you know, a house like Lincoln Center Theater is very much aware of that when programming.
So it's interesting, like, given the location of Lincoln Center Theater and the kind of like the cultural like milieu that supports it, that advocates for it, associated with it, whatever, it makes sense that this liberal Zionist play is pitched to them there, is connected to that place, because it is ultimately, to get back to the text, that question, this text, like looking at it as a whole, it's kind of it's this weird kind of like eulogy to a fictional kind of liberal Zionism that died a long time ago, decades ago, and possibly, and I mean, from the perspective of the Palestinians, it is irrelevant largely because Zionism is Zionism and its different factions inside of it are, it's six one way, half a dozen the other in terms of the effects on their lives, the deleterious effects, obviously. So it's interesting that then this play, you know, come movie and stuff, it begins in this cultural milieu and it begins with this thing of this friendship between, because then it gave him a perceived access. I mean, it did give him access, right, to fictionalizing this story or sort of rendering it real. Because historical drama, as something like this especially, it needs verisimilitude to like draw, to like sustain its own importance. So like this text is self-consciously historical, or trying to be at least, whether, you know, I'm not an expert at anything, like I'm not an expert in Oslo negotiations, so I can't really judge it on that front, but we can judge it on a lot of different registers, I'm sure. Because at the outset, well, it's a very stupid movie. I mean, it is a dumb movie. It's not dumb. Like, it's not like I watched Stargate the other night. Like, that is a dumb movie and racist and all these things. And this is a dumb movie and also racist, but it's a different kind of dumb and dumbness and idiocy and racism. It is, it's insulting. It's all the things. Anyways, yeah. What's your overall impression?
I mean, it's 3 hours of my life I'll never get back. One of the things that I found really interesting when reading more about this, because I had seen the play on Broadway and I was kind of half-half on it, but I thought it was much more effective as a play. And there are a few reasons for that. But when I was learning more about it, what I learned was that Rodgers and Cher, who developed this very collaboratively with Lincoln Center Theater, they interviewed Yulin Larson. And it's funny, they say, like, in some of the press leading up to it, Rodgers makes a big deal about how he went to Oslo, to the castle that they rented out for these negotiations. But he never mentions if he has ever been to Israel or Palestine. And I'm very curious to know if he had. But he basically said that he didn't want to, after speaking with Yulin Larson, he didn't want to spend more time talking to the actual people who were there. He wanted to have a little bit more freedom to fictionalize the story without feeling too beholden to history, which isn't in and of itself an entirely bad approach. The playwright David Henry Hwang, who wrote M. Butterfly, about the affair between a French diplomat and a Chinese spy who was posing as a woman in order to, you know, set up a honeypot trap with the French embassy in China. He had a very similar take where he said after he read the headline, he avoided learning more about the specifics of the event so that he could write this fictionalized piece about what it means, you know, this whole idea of Orientalism and of othering and exoticizing the East and kind of all these other dynamics with gender and things like that. And it's a very fascinating play, but it's very uninterested in presenting itself as an Aaron Sorkin script. And that was, I think, what made it so successful. But with Oslo, it is really just, I mean, someone compared it to Sorkin and Roger said that that was, you know, he took it as high praise. So
what a way to expose yourself as a Philistine.
You know.
Oh, that idiot self-righteous liberal who like is popular, but is also kind of a hack. I want to be endorsed by him.
I mean, at least Aaron Sorkin does his history homework. You know, he may not have the best take on it all the time, but he's at least reading the books. And one thing I fixated on for the piece that I was writing that was more about Cher himself was that he said with this play, we were going to tell the story we wanted to tell.